In 1888, Walt Whitman said, "I see great things in baseball. It's our game, the American game." He went on to say that this game, baseball, would get us outdoors, fill us with oxygen, and keep us from being a nervous nation. Although he may have been a fan of Major League Baseball, which began in 1869, he was probably talking about amateur baseball, which ordinary people used to play in just about every town. In Kansas, which was settling into statehood at the time, hundreds of towns grew up and formed their identities right alongside the game. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll meet the author of a new book about baseball in early Kansas, 1858 to 1941. Mark Eberle, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Happy to be here.
Thanks. Well, you know, I grew up reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, and the picture I got of Kansas during that time was, you know, like churning butter and basic survival type stuff. And I have this very separate idea of baseball that is probably informed by going to see Royals games. But it's been messing with my mind a little bit to try and work baseball into my existing picture of early Kansas.
Yeah, baseball was one of those games that people did for fun, both children and adults. It really kind of took off in the Civil War. It was easy to pack a ball and a bat with your kit and take it around on campaign.
Your kit. Tell me about what's in a kit.
The kit, the rest, the stuff they were supposed to be taking with them, the military gear.
Oh, gotcha.
And such. And so there were no gloves or anything like that. You just found a flat piece of ground and you started playing baseball. And that actually continued after the Civil War with military units that were on campaigns in the West. And so it just kind of became this way to relax, you know, to hang out with another group of your peers and relax during times that were not always so comfortable.
Are the bats and balls you're talking about, would they be recognizable to us now?
In general shape, sometimes it might be something look more just like the spoke off a wagon wheel as opposed to something that's nicely turned in Louisville or something like that now. And the balls initially didn't have that figure eight leather patching with them. They were just whatever they could sew together and throw out there. They were quite a bit softer in the early days.
Tell us the story of how you ended up doing all this research on the history of baseball in Kansas to begin with, because it started with a quest to satisfy a personal curiosity.
Yeah, I live in Hayes, Kansas, about halfway across the state toward Denver, and we have an old WPA baseball park with a grandstand built of concrete and limestone, and the WPA built a lot of stadiums of all kinds as part of their work relief programs, and so some of those are still around. And it had a plaque on it, like most of them do, that said built by the WPA in the city of Hayes in 1940. And I just kind of was curious, well, I wonder how many others are left in the state. Is this the oldest? Is it not the oldest? And so I just kind of started looking around and started talking to people, and it just kind of mushroomed after that.
Start by telling me more about this ballpark in Hayes, because I want to picture what this thing looks like and the role it plays there now, because I don't know. I guess we think so much about Major League Baseball that the idea that there are still these totally functional ballparks in cities that don't have major league teams is, I don't know, it's a little off the radar.
Yeah, this ballpark, it's made of concrete and limestone, so that's why it's one of the reasons it's lasted so long. But when you're in that size town, a lot of different entities can share the ballpark. And in the case of Hayes, there's also a state university there. And so it's used during the school year by the university, and they have a lease arrangement. The city owns the ballpark. And then during the summer, we have one of several collegiate league baseball teams where college players that want to continue to play to kind of make their season more comparable to what a minor league player would have to play, if they can go from the college season right into a collegiate summer league, they can extend that season and get a little more practice in. The only thing that makes it maybe a little harder for them is they can't be paid, but that also makes it financially more viable for small towns to have those collegiate league teams. And so there are a lot of them in Kansas and Missouri.
So is that really woven into the social fabric of Hayes, that to go to games here?
The stadium's usually not completely filled, but they're called the Hayes Larks. That team has been in existence. It transitioned from just a town team made up of locals that wanted to play around the surrounding towns. And it's now transitioned to a completely collegiate league team, but it's had that name since 1946, and there's been a team there playing that entire time. And so it's got a very long history.
So you're a guy in Hayes who is observing this ballpark and thinking, I wonder about ballparks like this just in other parts of the state and how many are left. Tell us about the journey that stems from this.
Yeah, so I started looking to see if anyone was bragging because they knew they had an old one. Some people were. Some people didn't know how old their ballpark was when I came across it. And so I just kind of went around. Fortunately, there aren't hundreds of them still in the state. I guess that's a good and a bad thing. So it meant I didn't have quite as much traveling to do. But there are some in all different parts of the state, from the southwest to the southeast up to the northeast, and then ours out in the northwest. So I found 9 ballparks that were built before the Second World War that are still used for baseball by either high school age people or by adults in the summer.
The curiosity started by being about ballparks, but what did you start discovering that made you think there's something deeper here?
Well, as I started looking into the stories about the ballparks, looking in old newspapers and things like that, you also see the other stories that go along with it, the teams that were playing there and those sorts of things. And what I didn't really fully realize was how many teams there were. Literally hundreds of them. Nobody has a good count.
Hundreds within Kansas alone.
Yes. Yeah, because there are 105 counties, and every county had at least one. Most of them had several. In bigger cities, there would be a lot of them, too, concentrated in that area. But the thing that really struck me was the diversity of people that were playing that. This was a time of segregation, and so those ballparks were used not just by teams of white males, which were the primary occupants of those ballparks, but there were African-American teams in big towns and small towns both. It wasn't just Kansas City or Wichita or Topeka. They were in little towns all over the state. There were teams of American Indians that played in different parts of the state. There were teams of Mexican-Americans that played. There were teams of women that played. And so all these people had to play separately for the most part, but they all wanted to play baseball. And so there were so many stories around the ballparks about these people that kind of made the project mushroom into the book.
You write early on in the book, in part, that this is kind of a cautionary tale about segregation itself. I mean, can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that? Of course, I think most people would agree that segregation was not this wonderful thing, but how does the story of baseball in Kansas kind of lay that bare?
We're just in kind of a unique geographical position in that we had this image that Kansas was the free state, right? We were the one that kind of started the Civil War because of the wrangling over whether we were going to be free or slave and those sorts of things. And so we were kind of between the North and the South. And so a lot of people's conceptions came with them as they moved to the state, regardless of which side they were on. And so it kind of was a little bit of a struggle for those cultures to deal with that. But what ended up happening was Kansas was, for example, one of the very last states to openly have integrated baseball teams. There were a lot of segregated teams, but there were a few professional integrated teams, and most places around the country, those had already fallen to the wayside because we were on the fringe. The closest major league team was in St. Louis, and so we were way out on the western fringe of that, and so the rules that applied back east didn't completely hold true, although little by little, it followed the norm that was found across the rest of the country.
Tell me the story of one of these integrated teams and how it both survived for a long time and then ultimately ended up not being able to kind of resist the path that history was on.
I think the problem became when you went to professional baseball. And what happened was you started bringing in players from all different parts of the country as opposed to just the locals who knew everybody, regardless of what race or gender they were. And when the professionals came from these other parts of the country, they brought their attitudes with them. And so that's where they started having problems with a lot of these professional teams. Mostly they were in the northeastern part of the state, Topeka, but there's some smaller towns up around Atchison and such, Troy, and some of those towns had integrated teams for a little while as well. And so when they stopped being local teams and started being these professional teams, that's when things started to change, because if we look at those places that still had strictly town teams, some of those were integrated well into the 1900s when all the rest of baseball was not. And so it was the outside influences that really started to bring that change.
Why focus on the period between the Civil War and World War II? That's the focus of your book, yeah. Kansas Baseball.
Yeah, it seems kind of weird to bracket something like that with something that seems so separate from it. But partly it was that the early days, just that how did baseball get started? Why is it here kind of a thing? Who brought it and why did they play it? Sort of a question arose. And going back to the ballparks, that period before World War II, the Great Depression, when the WPA was building the parks, that's when we still have these physical features that connect us to that long period from the Civil War to World War II in terms of the early game of baseball before things really started to change. After World War II, Jackie Robinson started to play for the Dodgers, and slowly integration started to take hold in the major leagues and the minor leagues. And so it was, there was kind of a block there that kind of made a nice uniform sort of story about the variety of things that happened in the state.
Help me understand just socially the role of baseball in these very earliest Kansas towns. What did it matter to the people of these towns in their daily life and their sense of themselves that they played baseball?
Part of it was just for the fun, but for a lot of the towns, it became about trying to survive. There were a lot of towns that were established. Farming was a much more labor-intensive sort of a process, so there were lots of little communities, most of which are not there anymore in the state. And so it became a way of, I mean, this same areas of western Kansas, even a little bit to the east, these were towns that were literally fighting with pistols and gunfire and kidnapping and theft to who was going to be the county seat. There was a lot of competition for who was going to make it and who wasn't, who got the railroad, who didn't. And with the baseball, it gave them a way to brag. We're the best here. And look what we did. We built this fine stadium. And so it was a way for them to promote themselves, especially during the summer when it was easy for people to travel about.
Well, I want to know from our listeners, you know, if you're from a Kansas town, did life in your lifetime revolve in some way around a baseball field, around a ballpark? We want to hear about baseball culture in your Kansas town in the past or in the present. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. And you'll be talking with Mark Eberle, who's written a book, Kansas Baseball, 1858 to 1941. Let's start at the beginning. I mean, you've mentioned that baseball was adopted by early settlers in Kansas, and it's fascinating to me. I mean, the rules of the game were not firmly established yet at that point.
Right. They evolved right on through the end of the 19th century. In terms of the pitcher had to throw underhand to start with. When baseball started in Kansas, it was more like softball, in a sense, in the way the pitcher had to throw the ball. And even into the late part of the century, the distance the pitcher had to stand back once they could start throwing overhand didn't happen until the 1890s, the distance we associate with the diamond and how everybody's positioned now. So it was a long progressive sort of change.
I know that this might just seem like a really random question, but why baseball? Is there a reason why this game in particular took hold and not, like, I don't know, cricket, bowling?
Yeah, I mean, those others were played, but I think part of it has to do with the fact that it was the summer game, the outdoor game. Early basketball wasn't played inside. It was played outside on fields, too. But baseball was the sport that you played in the summer when the days were longer, right? There were no lights on these fields back then. And so if you worked, you know, on your farm or you worked in a business, there was a six-day work week then, not 5 days, 40 hours. It was 6 days work until the early evening. So having that longer period to go out in the evening and do something outside just to relax and take the stress of the day off. Baseball was just the sport that was played at that time.
And then you write about teams that were formed specifically to represent African American communities, Native American communities, Latino communities, and women in many of these towns. How did that start happening, that different communities started forming teams? Were there obstacles to any of these groups forming teams?
Yeah, there were. I think with the African American teams, they started basically contemporaneously with the white teams. So a lot of it may have come from the military experiences they had during the Civil War as well. And so they were self-organized, like the white teams were. But with the American Indian teams and later the Mexican American teams, it was more a process of assimilation, not necessarily to integrate those people into the society, but basically to try and get them to participate in the American culture. And baseball was the national pastime.
So that was something that was encouraged from the outside and not like organically taken up by these groups?
Yeah, not that they didn't enjoy it, perhaps, but yeah, a lot of the Indian baseball started at the Indian schools, at Haskell and Lawrence, and there was another one to the north, the Kickapoo Training School. And so it was one of those things that was meant to kind of take them away from their culture and try and make them part of the quote-unquote American culture. And so it was a different genesis for those people.
How did you go about researching these teams? I mean, they, I'm guessing, are not still in existence today, or are some of them?
No, most of those are all gone. But it was, they were all written about in the newspapers. It was big news that they could write about every day. And so all of them got a certain amount of coverage, more for the town team that was representing the boosters in that community that were trying to make the town survive. But there were stories about all of those teams in the papers, that and who they played and what they were doing at the time. So
were there any players whose stories you were able to piece together through these reports?
Yeah, there were a few. One of the questions I get a lot of times is, you know, questions about major league players. And I purposely tried to kind of avoid those people, to talk about,
like, people who grew into a major league career.
Yeah, the Walter Johnson story from Southeast Kansas, one of the best pitchers ever in baseball, was from Southeast Kansas. So everybody that knows baseball in Kansas knows him. There's biographies about these people. And so I wanted to tell those stories about more of some of the local people that were just playing this game because, well, it was kind of fun and they like playing it. And so, yeah, there were a lot of those stories out there. I found one person, actually a man and his nephew in Southeast Kansas, African Americans, who were able to play on integrated teams well into the 1920s. And then the nephew got on with the Monarchs and some other teams in the Negro Leagues. But they were playing for all kinds of teams around. He was, Pomp Rigger was such a good pitcher that they were willing to let those rules of segregation break down, at least on the baseball field, because he was going to help them win.
Well, let's hear from Russ in Pleasant Hill, who wants to ask a question about this, okay, about this matter of segregated teams versus integrated teams. Russ, good morning.
Hello, thank you. I'm having a hard time understanding the terminology, or maybe the chronology. You talk about integrated teams being something that eventually went away because of interaction with the outside world, and I think of us as integrated now because we're not disintegrated. Segregation was long past, even in South Africa, let alone here. Are you saying that teams were originally integrated and then they became segregated until the U.S. started growing up after World War II? Or is it a different meaning of integrated? I don't really understand the terminology. I will accept my answer via FM, and thank you.
Thanks, Russ.
Thanks, Russ. Yeah, mostly the integration was not common. It wasn't necessarily widespread across Kansas, in which there would be one or two African-American players that would play on a white team. And where it started to disappear was the professional teams, as the major leagues started to evolve in particular. They basically had the unwritten rules, there will be no African-American players on our teams. And it was based on appearance as much as anything, because they had discussions about, is that Cuban really an African-American or is he a Spaniard? And so they just had their own rules that they kind of went with as the years progressed. But so the professional teams became segregated completely. what the integration still continued was in the town teams, the ones that were basically just local semi-pro players. Maybe they got a little bit of money from the gate receipts. But those town teams that were using their own community players to play, they remained integrated after 1900, but the professional teams were not.
We had a caller who was interested in whether the history of the Monarchs here in Kansas City was at all tied up with the history that you were researching.
It is to a degree. I mean, because technically they were Kansas City, Missouri. But of course, they barnstormed all over. And
when you say barnstormed,
that means between the games they were playing, if they were in the league, they just went out and played whoever and made money. So it was a way to keep them financially viable. And so they would do trips around Kansas and elsewhere in the country during these off periods between games with the leagues. And during the Great Depression, they basically were a barnstorming team entirely. And I noticed as I'd go around to a lot of these little communities, some of the older citizens, the first thing they would say if I asked them about baseball in their town was, oh, you know, the Monarchs were here. I mean, everybody remembers if the Monarchs or Satchel Paige played in their town, whether they
even
saw
if it was
it
just
not.
Once.
And a lot of times it was just once. And so they are part of the story because they are tied to Kansas in terms of, you know, going around and bringing in huge crowds, crowds that would exceed the population.
So in, you know, that does bring up the question of who all these teams are playing.
Yeah, it varied a lot. I mean, for example, we think there's not much in the book about college baseball, little bits, because they weren't organized in the same way they are now, just playing other college teams. They might play the local town teams because traveling was just really difficult. I mean, if you look at college teams around 1900, they're traveling by train. These games were not every night like they are nowadays. We tend to think of baseball as being a 6 or 7 day a week sport. If you had to pay money to ride on a train, you know, several hundred miles to play the next town, it cost a little money, so you were going to be a little more hesitant to do that. So you played who was close, and that applied to college teams as well as the town teams. Whoever they could end up playing, they played.
We've talked somewhat about the history of the culture around baseball and just this tier of play that is, I don't know, something that we don't see quite so much anymore or think about so much anymore. But it all started with this research into ballparks, and I'm curious about the relationship between the parks and the people in these towns.
The relationship in...
between these physical places. I mean, it started with this journey to explore these 9 surviving ballparks that fit very specific criteria that maybe you can spell out, but what was the relationship between those places and the people who once inhabited them?
It was just, for me, it was just interesting seeing the processes they went through to try and build those parks. They weren't universally promoted. There were people who went, hey, we got other things to do. I mean, even now, not everybody in town goes to the baseball game or watches the baseball game on TV even. And so, the arguments they would make to try and build a ballpark and whether they should or not, whether it should be located where it is or those sorts of things. A lot of the ballparks didn't survive because they were too close to good property that we could sell for another reason. We could put businesses on it or houses on it. So, okay, now we got to move the ballpark. Is it really worth moving? Who's paying for all this sort of a thing? And so there were lots of questions that would arise as these towns decided whether they were going to have a ballpark, whether they were going to keep it up, and whether they needed to replace it. And so the ones that survived were fortunate because they got a lot of their money came from the federal government. You know, they had to do their match, but these ones that survived were the ones that the WPA or a similar project built. And the federal government was trying to put people to work, and they covered most of the bills. So the towns were able to build that ballpark and that school or whatever it was they needed to build.
I was going to say, I mean, so many of those public works projects were infrastructure things like bridges or things like schools that are sort of, I don't know, serve specific needs of everyone. And it seems to me that there must have been a view that baseball fields, that ballparks filled that role, that kind of a role.
Yeah, part of it was just, I mean, when you consider the period, what you were able to do. I mean, motion pictures weren't a big deal at that time and those sorts of things. So it was the dance in the winter or something at some hall or whatever it might be. But they could also use the ballparks for other features. It was oftentimes the place where they went to watch the fireworks go off on the 4th of July, or they would have some politician or some Chautauqua would come and have speakers in front of them standing out on the diamond so they could use them for those kind of presentations. So they were really kind of outdoor theaters in a sense.
Do you have a favorite ballpark to tell us about?
I don't know if I should say.
No, you should. You should.
They all have really good stories.
You love all your children equally?
Yes. And so it's hard to pick one. And I've gone to all of them multiple times. And so I hesitate to pick one. But we have some of the best in the country.
Mark Eberle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mark's book is Kansas Baseball, 1858 to 1941, from the University Press of Kansas. Up next, the role of student journalism on high school and college campuses. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. In recent years, college campuses close to home have experienced public turmoil and transformation, from sexual assault stories to protests revealing racial unrest. And in many cases, what's brought these issues to the public eye is a student journalist. A bill that would protect student journalists from administrative censorship was proposed in Missouri this year. It passed the House, but didn't make it past the Senate. The bill would have ensured a student journalist's right to expose things that a school might not want getting out there. So now we're going to check in with student journalists about how that all works now. How and why do student journalists get their school's sometimes dirty laundry onto the pages of the school paper? I'm joined by a managing editor at the University News of UMKC who worked on the coverage of a rape incident in one of the dorms. Esme Sang, good morning.
Hi.
How and when did this story come across your radar?
So the actual assault happens on a Friday. I think it was the last Friday of February. And then UMKC administration had heard about it the next day, but didn't say anything to students or faculty at the school. And then it was the next Wednesday that the news broke on local news channels, and that was how most of us found out. And then after that, it was kind of a mad scramble to get the story out on our paper.
What were your thoughts as an editor of the school's paper as you thought about how to cover this and how or whether to involve the administration in what you were doing?
Well, we're kind of obligated to go to the administration whenever really important stuff like this happens. We just need to go to them and get a statement. So that was actually the first thing we did. And then a few others of us went and talked to students, and that's kind of the approach that we usually take.
Why did you think that it was important for the University News to tell the story and not just leave it to the local media, who had already started telling it, to go ahead and dig things up? Was it important for the story or a version of it to come from within the school?
I think so. So the local news kind of just has like a 200 or 300 word story about it, and then there's like a 5 or 10 minute, you know, bit on the news, on television news. And we wanted to get more of an in-depth story and get student reactions and get more of the details of how this could happen, just because there was a lot of concern about how it happened. The suspect was able to, or the perpetrator was able to carry her in unconscious into the dorm, and that was a big concern for all of us.
In terms of how that wasn't sort of noticed and intercepted.
Exactly. Yeah. And it ended up bringing up a lot of concerns about security. And the university has since stepped up a lot of the measures that it takes for people who come in.
Is it partly about audience, too? I mean, the local news would be talking to all of Kansas City, and you would presumably be speaking specifically to a campus audience.
Definitely. I think we became kind of a source for students to understand more of the details of how administration was going to address these issues on campus. So it's a really localized story, and I didn't think that local news would approach it the way that we would, just because their audience is, you know, the rest of the city, kind of an outsider view, and we're kind of a source for people who are within the UMKC community.
Esme, some of our listeners might recognize your name because you were involved in a big local news story a little more than a decade ago when you were in high school. And we're not going to get into that story right now, except to ask whether that experience of being in a media spotlight affects how you approach other people's stories, especially in sensitive situations like the one you were covering.
Definitely. So, yeah, that was 12 years ago. And it's kind of guided me to understand that, you know, when you approach journalism, you're not just writing in a way that's convenient and easy for the audience. And I think a lot of reporters kind of make that mistake instead of approaching it in a way that's true and fair to the people who are actually involved.
Can you explain what you mean by the difference between convenient and true?
Yeah, so I think people like to come up with their own explanations and things that kind of fit with, you know, various events. And sometimes it's hard for reporters to just admit when they don't know the whole story. And sometimes it seems like they fill in the blanks. And I've always tried to be a little more fair than that.
So when you approach either this assault story on campus or another story in your experience as a student journalist, what are some of the blanks that you've had to let be blank?
So a lot of it is with, I guess, being specific to UMKC. A lot of times there are policies that I don't understand. There's a lot going on in the background of decisions that administrators make behind the scenes that we're not, as students, we're not going to be privy to. So that was, especially in regards to the assault, with the security issues going on, they had investigations that were going on about the breakdown that happened that morning that, you know, we had no way of understanding or knowing the details of. And that was just something that we had to accept and move on from.
So just accepting that what happened behind closed doors, you can't necessarily deduce from what emerges from those closed doors?
Exactly, yeah.
All journalists have bosses, and there's always someone paying for what you do. So in professional journalism, there's what's known as a firewall between the sources of revenue and editorial decision-making. So like KCUR has a team of employees who work with donors and underwriters, and those of us in the newsroom cover what we cover without knowledge or pressure related to any of that. Is there an equivalent when it comes to the relationship between student journalists and administrations?
I mean, we've never had our funding threatened or anything, if that's what you're asking. So, no, I don't think so.
Or just a sense that there's a power dynamic between students and administrations that would seem maybe kind of tough for journalists if they're trying to expose something going on at the school.
It is tough. And I think every student journalist is aware of that dynamic and kind of, you know, proceeds accordingly. I will give credit to, you know, the UMKC administration in that they've recognized like what we were trying to do and they understand our role. Chancellor Leo Morton was, you know, more than understanding that we're going to print. He even made the comment a few times, like, is there going to be a story? And I feel like he understood that he really couldn't tell us what to write or what not to write. And I think that carried through the rest of the administration as well.
Well, let's hear from a high school student who made national news this year when her school paper exposed that a newly hired principal's credentials were kind of sketchy. Trina Paul is with us from Pittsburgh High School in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Hi, Trina.
Hi.
A lot of our listeners have probably heard this story, but why don't you give us a recap? You and your friends basically figured out that this new principal's master's and PhD degrees on paper were kind of bogus.
Yeah, so we had a writer, and she was going to write an introductory story on our new principal. The new principal had never arrived at her school. She was supposed to be coming from overseas, and she had claimed she had a PhD, a bachelor's, and a master's. We later discovered that she had none of those degrees, and it was through internet research, calling various sources, whether that was in the city she had said she had went to college in, and it was through that we discovered that most of what she had said to us was false.
What inspired you to start digging into the details of her resume and confirming everything? The school board and superintendent were totally convinced that she was the real deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we had initially started writing the story, we merely wanted to know kind of what her background was. And when we looked at the university, we immediately thought to ourselves, well, we've never heard about this. So we did a quick Google search, and what showed up next was not what we had ever expected, and we knew we had stumbled onto something larger than any of us.
What did turn up? What was this unexpected thing?
It was that the university she had attended, or that she'd claimed she attended, was a diploma mill, that they handed out diplomas for easy cash.
So, I mean, what did you do next with this information? Did you go to your supervisors at the school, or did you go ahead and keep digging and keep churning out the story that was eventually going to appear in your paper?
So our advisor, Emily Smith, was a really big source of support. She told us to publish the story. We did go to an administrator about two or three times. Repeatedly, he told us there was nothing to worry about, that there was nothing to see. We even did a Skype interview with the incoming principal, and none of these actions never put our mind at ease.
So you kept bringing the information you were finding just for other people's knowledge before you printed it in the paper?
Yeah, we're taking it to an administrator, not to the public.
Right. So the first time that it sounds like people were taking what you found seriously was when you actually printed everything you had found in the school paper. Can you tell us what happened when you printed the story? How did things change from there?
Okay, so we published, I would say, on a Friday, and immediately afterwards, we had an administrator go into our local newspaper and refute our claims. But within the next few days, the Board of Education accepted the incoming principal's resignation, and it seems that the administrators had a change of heart between then, and then just a few days after that, national media kind of descended on us.
So this is kind of crazy because, I mean, if we're asking the question of what is the significance of journalism within a school's community, it sounds mm-hmm. like if you had just been students who dug this stuff up and started trying to talk to people about it, that it doesn't sound like had the result that printing it in a school paper had.
Yeah, absolutely. If we had not been able to have like the press laws that we had in the state of Kansas, I don't think the end result would have been as it is now.
Can you explain what you just said there? I'm not sure I got it.
Like the press laws in the state of Kansas are really, we don't have, as student journalists, we don't have to go to administration before we publish. So if we hadn't been able to publish in the paper, I don't believe that what happened otherwise.
So it sounds like you're saying it's important that the administration not be able to block publication of stories by student journalists,
mm-hmm.
which is, yeah, exactly the law that did not just pass in Missouri.
Yeah.
You know, I'm guessing that most of what you publish in your school paper is not the kind of high stakes journalism that we're talking about. Do you think that it's important for a high school to have student journalists doing what they do, even if 99.9% of what you write about is more incidental stuff around the halls of school?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in any college or university or high school, it's important to have a source of news who's reporting the facts.
Esme, weigh in here. I mean, not everything in UMKC's University News is exposing a danger on campus like your reporting on a sexual assault incident was. Do you need that apparatus in place, like when something big does go down? Or is even that incidental kind of reporting important for some reason?
I think the incidental reporting gives kind of every group on campus to have a voice. So we have reporters who just kind of get into the get practice just covering stories, so then when those big stories do hit, it's not something out of the blue and they don't know how to approach it, and so there is like a procedure and steps that they can take.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, one local college paper is going online only. Does that change things, or is it the same service in a different format? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've just been talking about student journalism with a college journalist from UMKC and a high school journalist from Pittsburgh High School in Pittsburgh, Kansas. They've both been involved in exposing unpleasant truths at their schools. And one of our students here, Esme Sang, was praising Chancellor Leo Morton at UMKC for his support for the investigative work that the students were doing for their paper. It's just, we have breaking news that Chancellor Morton is planning to retire. He's just announced that. So, Esme, I wonder if you have a response to that news.
I'm worried who the next one will be, I guess, and how accessible they'll be to the U News.
Well, I'm sure KCUR will be covering this news and talking to lots of people about it. But, yeah, it's interesting within the scope of this conversation. And now we are going to switch gears to hear about a big change for the paper at Johnson County Community College. For that, let's welcome Nell Gross. She's the editor-in-chief of the Campus Ledger. Hi, Nell.
Hello.
The Campus Ledger is going online only. What's the story of that?
Well, over the past couple years, we've had a lot of problems with staff cuts and just having our staff being so greatly reduced and trying to split our time between working on a print paper and then our website. It was too much for having such a small amount of people. So we kind of weighed out the options and realized that moving now with all of the journalism moving mostly online and having so much stuff online, we realized that we should put more of our time there and have our reporters and our staff members kind of work on building their skills in those areas instead of working on print stuff.
So the students, you guys led this change just based on the budget pressures or no?
No, we didn't have much say in it, but I think that we all kind of agree with it after we all experienced what it's like having to split the work up.
So the workload sounds like a big part of it. Are there not, I guess when I was in college, there were so many students who were really interested in being involved in the school paper. As careers in journalism change, it's not totally surprising to me to hear that not a lot of the student journalists are looking at the print newspaper as their thing.
Yeah.
Tell me more about what student journalists are interested in doing.
Well, we work really closely with our video production people, JCAV, and we actually have our radio station, ECAV, that we work pretty closely with. And people are more interested in learning how to make multimedia packages and work on kind of coming together, converging, and making packages that aren't just a 500-word story, but having different media elements, like maybe a story or an audio clip in there along with some pictures.
So when the paper goes online, this is something I've been curious about. On a campus, it does seem like the reason you pick up the campus newspaper is because you just sort of stumble past
exactly.
It. It's not like you've subscribed to it. And when people go online for news, a lot of time they're going to be going to the same news outlets anyone off campus is going
yeah.
to. Are you worried about people just coming in contact with the work you do?
I think it's definitely a worry that's there, but I think I'm confident that we already have a decent online base that we have to start off with, and I think we have enough skills to kind of market ourselves and put ourselves out there enough to get our name out there maybe.
So talk to me about what you think the role of a newspaper is on a college campus. Why is it important, and does this accessibility issue worry you from that vantage point?
I've always viewed the role of I mean, our paper and specifically the Ledger, I've always viewed it as, since we're a commuter campus at a community college, I think that it was always important for any student on campus or people visiting or anybody to be able to pick up a paper and see all of the different things that were going on, because it's not something that you think about. I think when you think of JCCC, you don't think about all of the clubs we have, all of the different organizations doing things.
So like opportunities to get involved in stuff.
Yeah. And I think that it put a lot of different clubs out there and definitely everything definitely gave them some like notoriety, I guess. So I think it kind of worries me that people won't be able to find out all of the other things going on besides just the academics.
Tell me more about your interest in journalism. What are you hoping that your work on the Campus Ledger will allow you to do out there in the world? This is kind of maybe a scary time to think about the next step beyond the campus paper if the newspaper is really your goal.
Yeah, I think that we've all kind of had to accept that if we want to go into journalism, that it's something that's always changing. You always have to be willing to kind of change what you want to do with your life. And you can't be too set on, you know, picking one thing, because that thing could be gone in the next couple years. So I think that
no matter what that thing is.
Yeah, no matter what that thing is. So adapting.
How old are you? Do you mind my asking?
I'm 18.
So you've totally grown up with this being a reality. And
yeah.
I hear in you something that it's hard to imagine hearing in a journalist beginning in a career in another generation. Even myself, I started working in print journalism in about 1999. And at that time, I remember an older colleague, when September 11th happened and there was like a mini recession right after that, a colleague of mine at that time told me, oh, we work in a recession-proof industry. Teachers and journalists, people always need them. And then the layoffs started. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're growing up with such a clear-eyed view of journalism, and you still wanted to do it. Tell me about why.
That's a good question. I think for me personally, it's something I've always done. I started my freshman year of high school, and I haven't been without it in so long. I've spent so much time learning about it that at this point, I don't see myself, I think, picking anything else, maybe incorporating other aspects into it. But I think writing and storytelling and the news is always going to be something that I love.
I want to hear from our other guests on this. Esme, saying for you, what about you? Why? Tell me about why a person embarks on journalism now, knowing everything they know about all of the changes that have disrupted the industry over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, so I would always go back to those ideas of being fair and balanced and trying to get the full story. I think we'll always have a demand for journalism. I think it's just the medium that changes. And, you know, now more than ever with everything that's going on around the world and politically, we just will always need somebody there to talk to everyone that's involved and get that whole story out there. So I don't think that will ever change. I think that, you know, Nell is very insightful about how that landscape is always changing in terms of print versus digital. And journalists just have to be adaptive. And I'm like myself, I'm not actually going into reporting. I'm doing the nonprofit thing. So I think the skills that you learn in journalism teach you a lot about just kind of navigating the landscape of social and political issues.
So journalism as a skill set, whether it's a career or not kind of thing?
Exactly, yes.
Seeing some nodding from Nell over there, too. What about you, Trina? You're still with us, and you're in high school, already making waves as an investigative journalist. Do you have role models, heroes, ideas about what it would mean to keep going on the path you're on?
I think what I've come to realize is that what happened at our school is just a microcosm of what is happening, kind of, politically, in the whole world with journalists and people in power, and that it's important to make sure those around us are being honest. And it's important that we serve as a source of truth, and especially in a world where that can be diluted occasionally. And just kind of that, just that we're here and we're just trying to tell the truth.
When people talk about fake news or things like that. I mean, when the credibility of journalists gets called into question, you as a high schooler, it sounds like you do trust journalists. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so I think that with, I don't know, yeah, with the recent political climate, it's easier to, I guess, distrust mass media and to assume that those in power are more trustworthy. But I think I go back to something Hassan Minhaj said at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
What's that?
Honesty. He said, right now, a lot of people feel that trust is more important than truth. But at the end of the day, it is truth and it is honesty that essentially is more significant.
Trina, thank you so much for speaking with us from Pittsburgh, Kansas this morning.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And Nell Gross from Johnson County Community College, Esme Sang from UMKC's University News, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.